Tonight, Radio 3 live in concert from Liverpool Philharmonic Hall, starting at 7:30.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone midday. Time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Tamara Rojo is one of the world's great dancers. She's been principal ballerina with the Royal Ballet at Covent Garden since 2000 and is acclaimed for her outstanding technique and her dramatic acting. Your early training, Tamara, presumably was back in your home country in Spain.
Yes.
And did you know from an early age that this was going to be what you were going to do with your life?
It's strange because I kind of knew instantly as soon as I worked for the first time into a ballet class when I was 5. That was it. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't know what being a ballet dancer meant. I didn't know you were supposed to be on the stage. I thought it was just about doing ballet class in a studio. And I just loved the whole atmosphere and the piano music and just everything about it felt so different from anything else in life and so perfect for me.
And did you feel that you had an instinctive reaction to music even from a young age, that it made you want to move?
Yeah, well, we didn't have television. My parents believed it wasn't a good thing. So in my house, the way and I'm an only child, so the only way I would play was to put all records that my parents had of anything, Vivaldi or Chitty Chitty Bamba, anything, and just dance like crazy in the living room. So that was something I always did.
Now, I think you find that one of the ways of preparing of getting emotionally set up is being in the wings and watching and listening.
Definitely. Especially when you're about to face something really big, something that is a difficult part. I need inspiration. I can't go from the dressing room and maybe listening to Amy Winehouse to get ready to suddenly be a swan or be a Sleeping Beauty. I need the orchestra to get me there.
So, in fact, the first piece is Swan Lake. And,
yes.
And is this one of those pieces where all sorts of things go through your mind as you're standing in the wings,
yeah,
listening to the prologue?
Well, there's a certain amount of fear before you do a ballet like Swan Lake. It's technically very difficult. There's a lot of expectations from the public. There's a lot of history, and great ballerinas have done it before me. So there's that. So I always, always make sure that I am in the wings to hear the prologue because it just reminds me of why I'm there. I'm there to create a tale. I'm there to tell a story. And somehow the prologue tells me everything I need to know about what I'm about to do.
And do you think, in a way, that fear, which some people would find crippling, especially,
yeah,
if they were asked to dance, but that fear is quite important because we do need adrenaline, don't we, to sort of just go up that notch?
Yes, I think that fear, to a certain extent, creates the magic. It takes you away from that controlling ability that you have developed through rehearsals, and it brings you to the magic, to something that you didn't think you could do, and to take certain amazing risks and just the excitement of it. And it's also respect for what you're about to do, so I don't think it's bad.
The prologue to Act One of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted there by Andrei Previn. So would you be doing lots of sort of stretches and bends while watching, absorbing the atmosphere?
I think by now I'm kind of putting on the shoes, trying the point shoes, and especially because in our version we don't have a break between Act One and Act Two. It kind of continues. So by now I'm just tying my shoes on and doing the last little jumps and before I put the costume,
Tomorrow, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that period that yielded all those great Russian scores. If you think Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, Stravinsky, Shostakovich, I mean, where would we be without them, in a sense?
Well, I don't think dance would have survived as an art form, because those are the great masterpieces of our history, of dance history. So without Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Romeo, all those people that build together with the Petit Pas, that build the classic skeleton of the art form, dance would be very different today.
Every now and then, you get to do something which is brave and new. In fact, the piece we're about to hear was so brave and new that originally Covent Garden turned it down, didn't they?
Yes, which had happened before as well. You think they learned their lesson, but they don't. Yeah, Kenneth MacMillan decided to create a ballet using Mahler's Song of the Earth. And in my opinion, it is his masterpiece of all the works that he ever did. Somehow he managed to capture the Asian, the Japanese atmosphere and sensitivity and look. And at the same time, the drama of Mahler's music. And it's just an amazing piece to watch and an amazing piece to be in it. But yeah, as you say, when he first announced he was going to do it, someone decided that that music was too good to be choreographed upon. So he ended up doing it in Stuttgart.
And I suppose the idea, too, that there might be a singer and all the rest of it, I mean, unnerved a more conventional music director at that point. Do you ever find, with something that is profoundly moving, like, for example, the end of Der Abschied, that you almost have to control your emotions, that it's almost, you know, I mean, not the equivalent of actual bursting into tears, but, you know, that it becomes almost too much and you can overdo it?
Yes, you have to control it, because my instrument is my body. And if I become overwhelmed by emotion, I can't breathe. For starts, I start sobbing, so I can't dance. And to a certain extent, I have to be quite disciplined with my mind and have half my mind indulge in the feelings and the other half keep sending messages and keep sending, you know, pick it here and fall that way and hold this arm and all these corrections that we acquire during the months that we rehearse on something are messages that I have to keep sending. So to a certain extent, I'm not there to enjoy it as much as to create enjoyment for someone else.
It's one of those great moments in music, isn't it? Ewig, ewig, eternity, forever.
Mm. Yeah, it leaves you speechless. And that's the amazing thing about music. It can explain everything without words. So there's nothing left to say. Usually when you're in a concert and you hear this, or when you're in the stage, the audience takes a while to react. They never clap instantly because they're immersed in this feeling that you're describing.
That was the end of the last song, Der Abschied, from Mahler's Song of the Earth, Das Lied von der Erde. We heard Janet Baker with the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Now, Tamara, I can't imagine a role more suited to your Spanish temperament than Carmen.
Yeah, I have to say it's my absolute favourite role, especially in the version of Matzek that we do at the Opera House.
This music is by Rodion Chadrin.
Well, it's his kind of adaptation of the original music. Score.
Yeah. So, and it's his take on it, which in a way is quite a dangerous thing to do, isn't it?
Yes, I agree. But I think there was a very specific reason for it, and it was that Fernando Alonso, who was the director of the National Ballet of Cuba, was going to create Carmen for Maya Plisetskaya, who is Schroederin's wife. Mm. So I think he took on this because really they wanted a shorter piece and a compact piece to be danced without words, without the singing.
To sort of distill.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Well, which bit shall we hear from it?
My favorite pas de deux somehow is the Torero and Carmen, because in this version, Mats explained that he just wanted two adults, in all honesty, to come together to give pleasure to one another. There is no hiding. There is no I love you or I don't love you. It just doesn't matter. It's, you know, two consenting adults enjoying each other's bodies to the limit.
Thank you.
I do remember you dancing that tomorrow, and it was, as you say, pretty visceral in a sense. The Torero and Carmen from the Carmen Suite by Rodion Chedrin, with the Russian National Orchestra conducted by Mikhail Pletnev. You've been very interested in doing new work and adventurous work. In fact, I think you feel it's absolutely essential for the art form.
Yes, as I said before, we need to continue to create our art form because it's very young and we don't have that much, really. I mean, if you compare with music, there is so many options, so much repertoire, you know, that in an opera house you can have hundreds and hundreds of different operas and concerts. And in ballet, you tend to end up repeating certain big ballets like Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, because they're guaranteed of a quality. Although we must respect that and continue to do that, we have to force ourselves to take risks and to look into what will be the art form of the future and invest in new choreographers and in new music and in new designers and all those things, just to keep it alive.
I've always thought that with, for example, people that specialise in Mozart and Beethoven, Schubert, even the Baroque period, that being exposed to playing contemporary music is actually very good for them because it stretches their technique and their imagination. I know there are some people that think that Royal Ballet dancers doing certain things with contemporary choreographers like, for example, Wayne McGregor and Christopher Wheeldon is not necessarily the best thing, but I imagine that you rather welcome that.
Yes, it's liberating. And the truth is, most of us are, as athletes, a lot more gifted and a lot more powerful than the people that were around where those ballets were created, where the classics were created. So sometimes it's limiting for us. You know, we can do a lot more. We have a lot more power, a lot more flexibility. We have longer limbs. We have more stamina, all those things. And to work with a creator gives you that chance to really stretch yourself as an artist, both physically and mentally. And as you say, then you look at the old rep differently.
It informs it.
Yes, and also it gives you courage to take it somewhere else, to go, well, actually, why should I do it like someone else did it 50 years ago? I'm going to do it my way, even if it's wrong, but I'm going to do it this way.
Arvo Pärt, our next composer, is somebody who actually turned his back on his own modernism, if you like, and mm-hmm. went back to older forms and derived some kind of spiritual quality, I think, from that. And music of great simplicity, but has a kind of meditative effect. Is that what you like in it?
Yes, it is a bit like you said. It leaves me speechless and it moves me in a very simple way, but it's usually really tender or really sad. And it gets to the core of the feelings. And it's something that, especially this piece, that has been choreographed many, many times. And I always feel dissatisfied when I see it because I don't think anyone has quite achieve what the music is. And it's something that maybe one day I will have the courage to try.
It must be quite nice to be able to sort of mentally store up pieces that you feel you could bring something special to.
Yes, I actually write them down now because I don't want to forget all these crazy ideas. So, I as you say, I have like a list of things that I will want to one day put in onto the stage.
Thank you.
I think for me it sounds what a perfect marriage should sound like, a long marriage, you know, at the end when you're an old couple and there's little you have to say to each other, but everything is in unison. I think for some reason I just see that when I hear that.
No, I can see that. Spiegel im Spiegel by Ove Pärt. Tasman Little played the violin and Martin Roscoe the piano. The accompaniment there could almost have been straight out of Bach, couldn't it?
Yes, it's true. It's that kind of simple, classic beauty.
And Bach is possibly your favourite composer.
It is, yeah. It calms me down.
So it's a perfect counterfoil to your Latin temperament.
Yes, and to my busy life and to everything chaotic.
You won an Olivier Award for a wonderful collaboration you had with Kim Branstrup, doing the Goldberg project for the Lindbury.
Yes, I always wanted to work with Kim Branstrup. I think he's a very interesting choreographer of today. And we were talking about ideas, and I went to see Mario Pariah on a concert, on a spare ticket that my boyfriend decided not to use. So I went, and he was playing the Goldberg variations. And I came back the next day and I basically said to Kim, well, I heard this last night and I really think it's worth giving a thought. And he was like, yes, I always wanted to choreograph the whole Goldberg variation. So that's how we decided to use it.
And it was fortunate that there was a very good pianist, he's retired now, but Philip Gammon, who was able to undertake that, because you do need somebody that is going to be able to turn out a fairly virtuoso performance.
Yes.
I mean, virtuoso is perhaps the wrong word for Bach, but you know what I mean, it needs to be, you need to be on top of the music as you need to be on top of the dance.
Yes, poor thing, he got really nervous because actually Mary came to see the show. I haven't heard or read somewhere that he was part of the reason for what we were doing. So I know that it was one of his most stressful performances of his career at the end.
Well, let's choose one of the variations to give an idea of it. Which one would you like to
hear?
Yes,
actually, variation number 25.
Did that bring it back?
Yes. Well, the whole project was based on repetition, on the nature of the music that is kind of repetitive but evolves. So Kim came up with the idea of doing a rehearsal studio and recreate that atmosphere where we go every day to kind of repeat the same things, hoping that magic will happen and that it will take it to the next level and so on. And at this particular moment is when everybody left and I'm left alone in the dark in the studio. And then suddenly a figure that had been watching but never been involved comes up and just dances with me. And somehow is the arrival to that moment that we've all been working for, but no one is watching, no one witnesses. And it's a bit like a dream, like when you're stuck trying to create something and then you hear it in your dream and then you wake up and you lost it. Well, this song is a bit like that.
We heard Murray Pryor playing Variation 25 from the Goldberg Variations by Bach. When you are doing something like Romeo and Juliet, and it must be wonderful, like you did at the O2 with Carlos Acosta, then is that very different from having done it with something like Jonathan Cope?
Yes, it is very different, actually. And that's part of the joy of my job, is that I get to dance with amazing artists. And I feed from them as they feed from me. And you mentioned two of my best partners. I mean, Carlos is fearless, is an animal of the stage. He is really someone that has no fear and is a joy to be in it.
You're not without your animalistic side.
No, I am not. I am not. But somehow, having danced with him for so long, I think that side of us that we relate to, that we know, you know, we're together. But, you know, keep an eye on me because I'm there for the winning. And he's the same. So it's almost like a competition on the stage. With Johnny, it's a lot more intimate. It's a strange... With Jonathan Cope, you dance like no one else is there, especially things like Mayerlin. We really couldn't care less if there is 3,000, 5,000, 50,000 people watching because it's just him and me. And he manages to create that. And then just now I started to dance with Sergei Polunin. And I think he is probably the closest thing to Nureyev in that, again, that animalistic nature and that creative instinct that he has.
I suppose, Tamara Rojo, it's a bit like a cellist working with a conductor. You know, I've seen conductors and pianists and violinists and cellists sort of smiling at each other as they realise, as a moment of recognition, I know what you're doing there.
Yes.
And I'm going to answer this with the orchestra, you know.
Yeah.
It's like chamber music. And that's rather appropriate, really, because the piece we're going to hear next, especially in this recording, was an extraordinarily dynamic experience for everyone and given the outcome of this person's life, a very tragic one. Presumably you saw this on film, did you, first?
Yes, I saw the famous DVDs recordings that were available when I was a teenager.
This is Jacqueline Dupré playing the Elgar Cello Concerto with Barbirolli conducting the LSO. Yeah.
And I think I fell in love with the drama. I fell in love with the story of Jacqueline, with the talent and the beauty, and then the tragic ending. I think the whole thing, not that I'm taking away from her quality as a musician, but somehow she's a legend, and she's a legend partly because of her terrible ending.
It could have been a ballet almost.
It is a ballet. Somewhere there it
Here's
is.
Here's another one to add to your list tomorrow. Well, I mean, it's always wonderful hearing the first movement of this, because the moment when the bow first hits the string is sort of electrifying, isn't it?
It is. It's orgasmic. It's so good.
Thank you.
The wonderful thing about music is that sort of unspoken communication. For example, we both looked at each other at those moments where, if you like, the wave breaks over the top and smiled. And that's what great music can do. We heard there Jacqueline Dupré with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by John Barbirolli, in the first movement of the Elgar Cello Concerto in E minor. You mentioned earlier that you really like the music to sort of be honoured and not pulled around. And I get the impression that conductors are much less pulling music around. Yes. They feel that they must let it speak for itself. And that, of course, then in turn, as you say, inspires the dancers.
I think especially in the West, I think it's still in Russia, there's a lot of importance given to the tempo of the ballerina, so much so that as the ballerinas have gone taller, things are getting slower and slower and slower, things like Actus on Lake, and it takes away from the drama, it takes away from the story, and it becomes just an exercise of indulgence. That's what I have a problem with. I think you need to push yourself artistically and remember why you're doing what you're doing. The steps themselves, out of context, don't mean anything. So they have to be carried by the music.
We're going to finish with a trip to your mother's kitchen back home.
Well, I choose this piece because literally as soon as I hear the beginning, I'm back at age 9 doing my homework, my mom cooking dinner, just listening to the radio. And this the type of music that really brings me back to Madrid and to my mom.
That's the authentic sound of Spain. Granada, we heard Paco de Lucía, Andrés Batista and Malo Sanlúcar playing the guitars. Are you a great fan of flamenco?
I am. I think there's a point in your training. In Spain, we'll do flamenco when we start. And there's a point in your training where you have to choose because the technique is so different that it makes your body shape in a different way. And I think I was about 11 when they basically said, you have to make a choice. And it was really difficult. I think especially in Rep like Carmen or Don Q or things like that, I take every liberty.
That little flick of the wrist or the chin. Yes. Well, Tamara Rocha, thank you so much for letting us hear this music, which has accompanied a lot of what you've done and sometimes just been incidental to it.
Thank you very much.
Tamara Rocha was talking to Michael Barclay, and she's reprising the role of Juliet opposite Carlos Acosta's Romeo at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden from next Tuesday onwards. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
If it's Sunday morning, it must be Rob Cowan.
It's a relaxing time for a start, and you're responsive to all sorts of music, which is the whole rationale behind the programme. The agenda is always to make things as interesting and as varied as I possibly can. So I have full-length works, all sorts of genres, all sorts of periods, represented not only in terms of the repertoire I play, but the recordings I play as well. I had one particular recording that I played on the programme that people found so moving that I had listeners pulling into the side of the road, texting me. Tears were pouring down their face because they were so affected by what they were hearing. And that's not by any means uncommon.
Sunday morning with Rob Cowan on BBC Radio 3 from 9 o'clock.
Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here on BBC Radio 3. And if it's Sunday afternoon, it's the Early Music Show. That's next. This afternoon, the subject is the music of three members of the Ferrabosco family, who all worked in England at the court of Queen Elizabeth I. That's straight after a summary of the news this lunchtime. The time now is 1 o'clock. It's read by Vaughan Savage.
The Prime Minister has promised to give shareholders a binding vote on executive pay in an effort to tackle excessive salaries. He told the BBC there had been a market failure, leading to some executives getting huge rises even if there wasn't an improvement in performance. Labour said there would be no point in giving shareholders more power unless there was greater transparency and simplicity in the way pay packages were drawn up. David Cameron has apologised after he described the experience of being heckled by the Labour front bencher Ed Balls as being like having someone with Tourette's syndrome sitting opposite him. He said he was speaking off the cuff and would have to learn to tune out the noise in the House of Commons. Arab League foreign ministers are starting a meeting in Cairo to review the progress of their mission in Syria. Ministers are expected to examine a proposal by Qatar for United Nations human rights experts to be invited to assist the mission. Greater Manchester Police have been given more time to question a nurse suspected of murdering three patients at Stepping Hill Hospital in Stockport. Victorino Chua is being questioned about the contamination of saline drips in June and July last year. He was originally detained on Thursday in connection with the falsification of medical records. Police have named a man and his three young siblings who died in a fire in Lancashire. They are Reese Smith, who was 19, four-year-old twins Holly and Ella, and their two-year-old brother Jordan. The fire broke out late last night at a bungalow in the village of Freckleton. It's not yet known how it began. Tens of thousands of people are gathering in the South African city of Bloemfontein to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the African National Congress. The South African president and leader of the ANC, Jacob Zuma, will address a rally which will be attended by other world leaders. The weather, some bright spells will develop, particularly to the east of high ground. It'll be windy in the northwest. The BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
Vaughan, thank you. Well, our Sunday concert in an hour features the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, conducted by Paul Daniel, and a concert given at the Philharmonia Hall in Liverpool. They played Walton's First Symphony. You can also hear music by Mark Antony Turnage and by Elgar. Our Sunday concert is at two this afternoon. That's after we join Lucy Skeeping for today's edition of the Early Music Show. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the show. That was a little galliard played by an old friend of mine, the lutenist Christopher Wilson. We were at the Royal College together, and as a mere violinist in those days, I think his lute was probably the first one I'd ever seen, close up at any rate. It's such a pretty sound, and it's an instrument that would certainly have been very familiar to the composer of that galliard, Alfonso Ferrabosco, an Italian who worked in England at the Elizabethan court on and off for some 16 years. An investigation of Ferrabosco immediately brings up a large and complicated family tree that dates back to the 1400s, to Alfonso's great-great-grandfather Domenico, who served at the magnificent house of the rulers of Bologna. He doesn't seem to have been a musician himself, but the family was to spawn at least three of them, a father and son and a cousin. And in today's programme, we're going to be focusing on the lives and the music of these three 16th century Ferraboscos. Alfonso, the oldest of them, was one of eight children. Like some touring theatrical clan, they all travelled with their parents to wherever the work was, to Rome, where their father sang in the Sistine Chapel choir, and then to France. Alfonso was still only about 12 or 13 years old at this point, but his new home must have impressed him. It was the palace of Charles of Guise, a powerful cardinal who surrounded himself with poets and intellectuals. And it wasn't long before he had the three young Ferrabosco brothers singing for his guests, who were evidently mightily impressed by their sweet tones. Gesture and sound and voice together, like three Apollos singing gently to the lyre, twittered the posh poet Pierre de Ronsard after hearing them. So the trois Ferrabosques Italiens, as the French called them, were wheeled out whenever music was required, which included performing at the wedding of the Dauphin to Mary Queen of Scots, who incidentally was the cardinal's niece. But by the early 1560s, at the age of 19, Alfonso decided to spread his wings and travel to England. And it was here, as one of the Queen's musicians, that he composed the two viol consorts we'll hear now.